The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Starting next month, the Green Mountain State of Vermont will require all residents and businesses to recycle, joining another New England state, Rhode Island. In New Hampshire, recycling is largely voluntary and varies town by town, with many Granite State communities doing more in recent years to encourage folks to throw those bottles and cans into a bin instead of the trash. But as the recycling ethic has become pretty common, the economics may be getting worse. Market prices for many recycled goods have plummeted, and some dealers in commodities from paper to plastic are seeing their profits plummet. That in turn has meant cities and towns keeping a closer eye on recycling's bottom line, worrying about the dollars and cents of the whole enterprise. Today in The Exchange, we reconsider recycling, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests in studio. Duncan Watson is here, Assistant Public Works Director with the Keene Public Works Department. And Duncan, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Also with us, Michael Durfor. He's Executive Director of the Northeast Resource Recovery Association, a nonprofit that coordinates recycling for New England towns. And Michael, nice to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, John Halstead. He's a professor of environmental and resource economics at UNH. And John, good to meet you too. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and I wanted to start with you, John, actually. A recent Washington Post article looked at the economics of recycling and came to this conclusion. Quoting here, once a profitable business for cities and private employers alike, recycling in recent years has become a money-sucking enterprise. Almost every facility in the country is running in the red. What do you think, John? How are the economics of recycling looking these days to you?
Well, for one thing, to talk about profit at the local level is kind of a little misnomer, really, because it's not the money you make from selling recycled goods that's really driving the system. It's the money you don't pay to a landfill. So it's really about cost avoidance. The big chunk of money you make on a ton of whatever is that you're not hauling it to a landfill and then paying that landfill to dispose that ton of material. Now the revenues, the prices for recycled products have gotten soft in recent years, but they've done it before. Recycling prices tend to be cyclical, and we remember the 90s when things were terrible, just terrible in the industry, and we kind of persevered and we rode it out. And if you look at why prices are a little bit soft, well, there's a lot of global explanations and a lot of macroeconomic explanations a lot of us are of a mind that you just weather this and prices will come back.
Well, and I'm definitely interested into why the prices have been so soft lately, as you said. But so when we look at the economics of recycling, John, it isn't so much, is this recycling program in Town X making money? It's how much more money would Town X be spending to send its stuff to the landfill?
Exactly.
That's the equation there. What are you seeing in cities and towns around New Hampshire, Michael Durfor, in terms of the economics of recycling?
Well, John expressed it exactly right. The real challenge for us is when those two numbers become equal. So if it starts to cost you the same amount as would cost you to dispose of a landfill, then you've got a real ethical decision to make. What's the right thing to do? And obviously, the nonprofit, we feel that it should be a recycled avenue, especially if it's the same cost, but even if it's more of a cost. And what's happened in the industry, that the Washington Post article is echoing some that's been out there for the last 6 months or so. We kind of saw this coming, which is why our conference focused on that exactly, that we just had in Manchester. The price has dropped to such a degree that those that are processing the material now are losing money, and they've got to make it up. And as John has said, it's been cyclical up until now, but the last year to 18 months, it seems to have stagnated to a new normal. Mike Nork from our staff coined that phrase about 6 to 8 months ago, and now it's being picked up by some of the corporations that they're showing that on their books. The markets aren't rebounding to the extent that they have historically, and there's a lot of reasons for that.
So this cycle is lasting a lot longer than folks would like.
And we don't foresee it coming out of it.
Talk a little bit about the private companies in this, because I think a lot of people, you know, they throw the recycling in the bin or they bring it to the dump and that's all done with it. But this is a complicated market.
It's very complicated. The thing that's really struck us is the value of the material that's being processed in these facilities. It used to generate anywhere from $100 to $150 a ton that they could sell the materials for after they processed. It cost them $75, for example, to process as a cost, so they had some good margin. They shared some of that with the towns, which they got revenue for their recycling.
So everybody's happy.
Everybody's happy. Come January of this year, that $150 number now is down to $40.
Wow.
You're only getting paid $40. You're still spending $75 to process it, so every ton that you process, you're losing money on.
So can these companies afford to stay in business?
As the article indicated, I think it was the waste management people lost $16 million in the first quarter. They're getting out of the business if it continues.
What's the concern then? Duncan, I'll turn to you, but I want to hear from everybody. You know, if this continues, if this is the new normal, can towns like Keene afford to do this?
Well, I mean, Keene's economics are specific to Keene, so it's difficult for me to project what other people are doing. But, I mean, I think the thing that's hurt recycling in the long run is that the perception is that recycling is free. And recycling is clearly not free. It costs money to collect recycling at the curb. It costs money to process it. And then with any luck, the cost of processing that material and then ultimately selling it will net out lower than the cost of your alternative, which is to burn it or bury it. In Keene, that bears itself out, and it has for a number of years. We have a facility that is somewhat unique in the way we process our materials. And so our costs continue to be considerably lower than our alternatives. So when we look at the economics of our situation in Keene, it's a clear win for us to continue to divert waste through recycling. But it's going to be coming more challenging as these numbers start to come together a little bit more with the market prices being down. When we sell our recycling commodities, when we make the revenue, that helps to net out the cost. If I just take the straight cost of my personnel to process the material, that number is much closer to the number that it costs to burn or bury the waste. But when I net the revenue out, which has always been pretty strong for at least the last 15 years, then it becomes a different equation.
I mean, are Keene City Councilors, you know, looking at this and saying, I don't know, Duncan, you know, this isn't working for us?
Well, every year we go through an exercise where we look at our operation. I mean, Keene has a unique situation in the sense that we are a special revenue fund in the city of Keene. So we are not supported by the tax rate for our solid waste program. All of our revenues come from tipping fees at our transfer station. When people come to bring in waste, they pay for it. And then we also make money from the sale of our recycling commodities. So that's how we generate revenue. There's no tax revenue going to our situation at all. So we operate as a business. And so we need to be looking at being in the black as much as we can. And that's what we strive to do with our operation.
Yeah. And John, most towns aren't like that, though, right?
No. I would say that's a pretty unusual situation. And that's kind of what a lot of towns would like to have is sort of a I don't want to compare it to the post office too much, but a standalone agency that really generates its own operating revenues.
I have to ask you this question, John, and then we'll talk more about the economics and so forth. How do you evaluate the greenness equation of recycling? You know, setting aside the costs for a moment. For example, if I've got a peanut butter jar, glass jar, it's all gooey with peanut butter on the sides. I need hot water to rinse it out, which has been heated by my oil-based hot water heater. And then later a truck using fossil fuels hauls it away. So now I've used fossil fuels twice just for this one peanut butter jar. Environmentally, never mind economically for now, environmentally, is that recycling really worth it?
That's a really good question. And you've really raised 2 points there. You brought up glass. And glass is a really, really low-value commodity to begin with. In fact, it's high volume, and it used to be there's a time you could get $20 a ton for a good, clean load of clear glass. And now it's used as roadbed and daily cover in landfills. It's basically the same value as sand, which is to say not very valuable. So I think I'm gonna be a little evasive, and I'm gonna say it depends on the material. If I see an aluminum can, I'll walk out of my way to get it, and I'll carry it around for a while until I find somewhere to put it because there's a lot of value in that can. If I see a plastic bottle off in the distance and I didn't put it there, it's litter. I'm not thinking I need to save the environment by recycling this little piece of plastic because that's. That's material where it's just not nearly as valuable. Now, it is – the plastic itself is valuable, but you have to get it to where someone can grind it up and make it into a new fleece vest. And that's the rub. It's not the plastic being worthless. It's so light, it takes so much money to haul it to somebody that can use it. And you do have to consider the whole life cycle of the recycling process. And so I would say with the glass, I know it's heresy, but
how does that come out on the green equation? Is it green or not?
I would say that if you did run those numbers, sometimes you're actually probably better off throwing certain things away in certain situations.
Wow. So let's say, and I can see you want to jump in, Michael. Let's say that peanut butter jar is plastic. Okay, again, setting economics aside, is it greener to use all those fossil fuels to clean it, haul it away, process it? You know, I'm sure the plant that processes it uses fossil fuels to power itself. Or is it greener to throw it away?
The numbers that John's indicated would probably tell you that in that particular case, if you're going to leave the peanut butter in, you probably should throw it away. And that's not what we want them to do. We want to make sure they eat all the peanut butter and then save the glass. But the glass is going to disappear over the course of the next 5 to 10 to 15 years. What we're seeing is a transition from what you, as you indicated, we've got glass containers and we've got Tide bottles that are heavy-duty plastic. All of that is now being replaced by lightweighting and plastic pouches. You see it in the kids' drinks. You see it in the grocery stores. Anything and everything that they can put into a pouch now is what they're going to ship it in because that drops their computation for the greenhouse gas piece. That puts a tremendous challenge to the folks that are now collecting that plastic because now you've got these light pouches that blow all over the place. They have no weight. And how do you get them into a bale so you can ship them back to be reprocessed?
All right. Lots more to dig into after a short break. And let's hear from you. What does your town do in terms of recycling? What do you yourself do? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the dollars and cents of recycling, the shifting economics around recycling. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions and comments. How much does your town or city emphasize recycling? A lot or a little? If you don't recycle much or at all, why not? What may make a difference for you? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Michael Durfour, John Halstead, Duncan Watson, we're going to go now to Vermont briefly, where they're getting pretty serious about recycling as of July 1st. It will be mandatory in the Green Mountain State. With us now to talk about that is Josh Kelly. He's Materials Management Section Chief at the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources. Josh, thank you for taking time out.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What's the big goal of this law, Josh?
I guess in short, it's to increase Vermont's recycling rate and to decrease waste, in essence. And the first push is on recyclables, as you stated, coming up this July.
And when you say increase Vermont's recycling rate, what is that rate right now?
It's been hovering around 30 to 36%, which is pretty much similar to national rates. There's kind of been a stagnation around this 30, 30, 35% rate. So we've been trying to move that for over a decade, and this this initiative is poised to help push that up.
So efforts to encourage people haven't worked out.
Yeah, I mean, I think the people who are really motivated have jumped in, but then it hasn't been exactly easy for everyone. In our state, you know, there's been places where you didn't have services for recycling, and not at the curb, not at least as conveniently as trash. And so Vermont's law not only it's really less about, you know, you not being allowed to put these in the trash, and more about having an opportunity to put them in the recycling bin.
Yeah, so how are you going to make it easy for folks?
Sure. Well, first, last summer, July 2014, transfer stations where folks brought trash were required to begin accepting recyclables. We actually had the majority of our transfer stations already doing that. So then we did do some checks, and it turned out we have all transfer stations accepting recyclables as of now. And then this summer, July 1, 2015, is when haulers who haul trash need to offer curbside services for recyclables.
How are you going to make sure, Josh, that people recycle? I mean, are people going to have to pay a fine? Are you going to dig through the trash looking for beer cans or what?
No, there's, you know, I'm constantly asked that question.
I bet.
And you know, there is not an emphasis on enforcement of residents for their, you know, for what they put in the trash. But that doesn't mean that it's not really important for everybody to recommit to recycling. And that's the essence and the intent behind Vermont's universal recycling law.
You know, we've had a lot of talks about this among our own staff, and some of us live in houses where it's a little more obvious. You know, you take it to the dump or you put the bin by the curbside, depending on your own town. But people who live in apartment buildings, that's kind of been a gray zone there. How are you going to deal with that, Josh?
Yeah, apartment buildings are a difficult situation for a lot of change initiatives, whether it's energy efficiency or, you know, or solid waste or materials management. And so what we've been doing at the Agency of Natural Resources is working closely with our local governments. In Vermont, we have solid waste districts across the state. They're beginning some outreach to educate residents. And then in addition, we have the Vermont Department of Health has some regulations on landlords and apartment houses. And so we've been working with them to make sure their regulations kind of conform to ours so that eventually landlords will not only have to, you know, remove trash bins and provide trash bins on a regular basis as is in their regulations now, but that they would have to allow a hauler to bring in recyclables and put in a recyclable container as the hauler is required to do. So it is a gray area, and it's an area that's going to take some time to work out. And I've gotten some calls from residents who've been in that situation. And so I encourage them to talk to their local solid waste district to see what services are available. A lot of people do bring their own trash in Vermont to a drop-off, a dump, as you say. A lot of people still call it that. So some of them have those options, but the curbside options are kind of scattered. So we're really hopeful that with haulers offering recycling services around the state, that much more convenient recycling options will become available to folks.
And I'm sure you're aware, as we discussed earlier, Josh, the economics of recycling don't look as pretty as they did a couple years ago. Prices for recycled commodities are way down. In some instances, it maybe isn't even worth it to recycle. What is that going to mean for Vermont's effort?
First, I would say, you know, I think in other parts of the country, the issue of whether it's worth it to recycle may be easier to debate. Certainly, the markets are down, and it's not helping anyone. It doesn't help the hauling community. It doesn't help our resident who thinks, you know, there shouldn't be any cost to recycling. The fact of the matter is there is a cost to recycling, and there's a cost to managing any material, and most of the time, it's the cost to take it from multiple producing locations and aggregate it, you know, collect it and bring it to scale where you can actually make something out of it. So I would say, you know, there's still a significant environmental benefits to recycling. And in Vermont, our costs to dispose of trash are still pretty high. And so what I'm seeing across the state is that recycling, even though the markets are down, and it's very unfortunate, and none of us are thrilled about that, it's still reasonably cost effective in most places in the state, if not all, to recycle.
All right. Well, Josh, we'll be watching to see what happens. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Josh Kelly, Materials Management Section Chief at Vermont's Waste Management and Prevention Division. Again, as of July 1st, recycling will be mandatory in the Green Mountain State. Give us a call. Your questions, comments, concerns about recycling in the Granite State are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Again, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Before we go to our listeners, gentlemen, Michael Durfour, how common is mandatory recycling in New England and around the country?
Well, I think you mentioned earlier the two states, Rhode Island and Connecticut, Rhode Island, Vermont, that we know of. The rest of it is pretty much town by town. There's mandatory recycling. There's pay-as-you-throw, which is the pocketbook way of doing mandatory recycling.
That's where you pay a dollar or $1.50 for a bag to throw your trash out, but you can recycle as much as you want.
Correct.
For free. Yeah.
Yep. And a lot of towns take it differently. It's really up to the managing select boards or town councils to adopt the policies and then to enforce them. For the most part, what we've seen is that in voluntary situations, transfer facilities that have had a long history of recycling since 1970 or so, with the first Earth Day, it's become part of the social fabric, if you will. They're going to recycle no matter what it costs because it's the right thing to do. We've seen some facilities at some towns where they've gone to a one-bin recycling program, and the residents still put it in the same slots they used to. They still separate it because they're so conditioned to do
that. One bin meaning single stream. You just dump everything in.
Correct.
Which
yep.
I definitely have some questions for you guys. But on this issue of mandatory, voluntary, I was interested to hear, Duncan, that even in the Green Mountain State where there's such a strong, strong environmental ethic, they only had about 30-35% recycling rate, which is about the same nationally.
Well, I don't know what the national statistics are specifically, but I always question everybody's recycling rate because it's difficult to measure what a recycling rate really is ultimately because of the way people bring either their waste to a place or their recycling to a place. All you're doing at any specific location is basically counting those things and then measuring some sort of percentage recycling rate. But like in Keene, for instance, we actually receive a lot more trash at our facility than we do recycling from because we get trash in from surrounding towns, but we don't necessarily get the recycling in from surrounding towns. So it makes our recycling rate maybe look not quite as good as it would otherwise be. But that said, I mean, I think that recycling is an important thing to do. People want to do the right thing. They want to know that they're contributing in their own way. And these individuals who are recycling their bottles and their cans and their paper are in fact making a difference. It is an important thing to do. It is an important public policy thing to consider and to continue to do. But I think that, as we face the economics of the situation going forward, we're going to have to come up with a better mousetrap.
Well, so is it still the right thing to do environmentally, given what John told us a minute ago about, all the fossil fuels that it takes to recycle certain objects?
Well, that one example of the glass is an interesting one. I mean, I actually did a study when I was in graduate school about disposable versus cloth diapers. And, the fact was is at the end of the day, it came out to be about a wash when you considered, the cost of harvesting cotton and the pesticides used in cotton and the production of cotton and all these things that came into producing cotton versus the energy that took to the fossil fuels to produce a disposable diaper and all the things. So those are, it's never a simple thing. When you consider what are known as environmental externalities, when you start looking at the macro portion of the economics of each recycling situation, it's basically a case-by-case basis. An easy
each
one.
Each product.
Right. Each product, it has to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. But an easy one, for instance, is the aluminum can. The aluminum can, as John mentioned, he goes out of his way to pick up the aluminum can and carry it around with him. I've done that before myself because the reason is because if you throw that can away, you might as well fill that can up 3/4 full with gasoline, pour it on the ground because that's the energy equivalent that you're going to waste by not recycling that can.
Okay, you're going to have to give us a little more there. What do you mean by that?
It means that the cost of mining bauxite to produce a virgin can is such that you're wasting that kind of energy by not the aluminum can be turned into aluminum can over and over and over again. It's a good recyclable commodity. And the energy equivalent of recycling that can is 17 times better than than producing it from bauxite ore.
Okay, but that lightweight plastic bottle that they have nowadays, where once you're done drinking the water, you can basically crush it with your hands, yeah. Not so much?
Well, that's where we need a better mousetrap for plastics. We need ways of being able to collect plastic, compact plastic, so that we're not shipping quite so much air, and then have processing facilities to process plastic in a more efficient way.
All right. John, go ahead, and then lots of people want to jump in.
The plastic bottle is another interesting thing. There are especially on UNH campus, there's a group that's really trying to eliminate the plastic bottle and go with reusable containers. And so there are a lot of questions here, like do we need all these plastic bottles of water to begin with is one thing. And with the glass example, again, it's not just a material by material. It's a jar by jar. Now, if I filled up the sink with hot water and washed out my peanut butter jar and then drove it to the transfer station, that's silly. But if I happen to stick it in my dishwasher, which had a little slack capacity anyway, and then I'm going to the transfer station anyway, so I tossed it in the bin, well, now all of a sudden the economics look a lot better. So if you're kind of strategic in a very minor way, you can – it doesn't look quite as bad now. Because
what do you think about Vermont's effort? I'm struck by the fact that even in Vermont, which has a strong environmental ethic, as I said, they were no better than the national average.
I think it reflects, if you look at the waste stream, what's in it and what we're not recycling, we need to kind of – at a time we're talking about do we need to contract, we also need to think about expanding into those areas where we're not recycling things. For example, there's a lot of organic materials that really aren't being channeled out of the waste stream.
You mean compost, banana peels, coffee grounds.
Potential compost, sure.
Yeah.
Leaf and yard waste.
Sure.
We need to crack into some of those things. I think that's what's – now Duncan and Mike probably have a better idea than I do of this, but I think that's – we need to find a way to make that next step into the 65%.
All right. Well, yeah, some people in this field call composting the next frontier. Lots of people who want to jump in. Gentlemen, let's go to them. Paul's in Nashua. Hi, Paul. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Yes, I was to see what the your guest thought about waste to energy as an option while the prices of recycling have dropped so much.
Waste to energy, in other words, using incinerators, yeah, and possibly harnessing that for electricity. I know there's an effort at UNH, but go ahead, Mike.
Well, that's an interesting one because the incinerator up in Claremont closed about 2 years ago due to the falling economics. It impacted them in terms of what they could sell their electricity they produced for, so that put a downturn on that. And I know that some of the burn plants around New England are struggling right now with that same model. So it's counted as part of recycling because you're turning it into fuel, so it helps your recycling rate.
I see.
But it's not necessarily any more economical in this market than the rest of the challenges we're talking about. And the ones that Vermont are facing, they're counting on the compost piece, the organics piece, to help them raise that rate significantly. We're in the process, and in the next 2 weeks we have to deliver to one of the solid waste districts that Josh referred to. They wanted us to do a current market analysis to give them some indication whether or not they should be building a facility like Duncan's in Keene, because they're struggling with the impact of 148. Now that you've told us we have to collect this, we can't throw it away. What are we going to do with it? Does it make sense to try and ship it to market? And I think that's the real challenge for all of these commodities. You look at them one by one, and let's say it doesn't make sense for that plastic bottle that we're making. We need to have a national conversation with the producers of that plastic bottle. How can we do this better so that we have an answer when it gets to the transfer station? Everything just gets transferred on. You buy a flat-screen TV, and you own the TV when you get home, but you also own a cardboard box, a plastic bag, and a piece of styrofoam, which you then take to your transfer station and say, here, it's your problem. You figure out how to deal with this, how to process it, how to make it. So that challenge of that economic path is what we've been looking at for a long time, and I think it's going to actually help us. This challenge will help us to improve.
Well, if they take it to the transfer station, I mean, styrofoam, for example, that's just trash, right? You can't recycle that.
You can actually recycle styrofoam.
You can.
It's
okay.
Not necessarily cost effective yet, but you can do it. We actually had a vendor and exhibitor at a conference that was going to make blocks and then ship full loads of styrofoam to be reprocessed into more styrofoam.
Well,
so the reuse loop.
To the point, John, about waste energy that our caller asks about, isn't there a plant, a landfill, excuse me, that is piping methane to UNH and it's being used to I don't know, run electricity or heat the water or what?
Right. That's the one of the large landfills in the state, the turnkey facility in Rochester. They recover the methane and it gets piped via what we call the eco line. And we burn the methane on campus as part of our that provides a lot of the heat on campus. So it's a form of materials recovery. And it's been a big selling point for the university as a green campus that
okay.
we do that.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for the call. And let's go next to Roger in Lee. Hi, Roger. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Yes. Good morning.
Morning.
So I heard the comments about glass, and my thoughts on the glass were we spend about, I think, $40 a ton, I will say, overall, to ship the glass and get rid of it, whereas our trash is $80. So it's better than throwing it away, but it's not what I would call something that recycling where we're making money. It's just a small avoidance. Glass is probably one of our biggest problems, and from the articles I've read, it's probably getting bigger nationally, the process of getting rid of glass. But then you've got things like aluminum can on the other end, and I'm away on vacation right now in Wolfboro, and I'm saving up every single aluminum can that we're generating. I'm going to take it back home because we're getting about $1,400 a ton, thanks to the NRRA, whenever we ship aluminum cans out. Plastic bottles I still think of as being somewhat valuable, but it's maybe half the price or a third the price of aluminum.
So, Roger, when you say we, it sounds like you're involved in this. We're getting so much money and here and there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm the lead transfer station manager, so I'm the one that tries to work to get the most money back from the recycling. The townspeople of Lee put the bar pretty high 10 years ago when they voted to build a transfer station that's drive-through, and it's the first one in the state where it's a single town, that I know of anyway, single town where we have a facility so well built to recover as much money from recycling. So we aim for somewhere between $55,000 and $96,000 a year of recycling income, and it's what we're really after. And then secondly, we're also after the environmental benefit of sending as little as possible to the landfill up
right.
the street. And,
all right. Well, and Roger, got to cut you off there, but we'll talk after a short break about that situation. Thanks for calling. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're reconsidering recycling, given some of the concerns about the costs of these programs and how the markets have crashed recently for some recycled commodities. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. How much does your city or town emphasize recycling? Does it do a good job or not, in your opinion? Also, if you yourself don't recycle much or at all, why not? What might make a difference for you? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Michael Durfor is here, Executive Director of the Northeast Resource Recovery Association. That's a nonprofit that coordinates recycling for New England towns. Also, John Halstead, Professor of Environmental and Resource Economics at UNH, and Duncan Watson, Assistant Public Works Director with the Keene Public Works Department. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Lance in Wentworth. He says, here is my silly question. Why isn't the onus of recycling put at the source? Who can forget milk and soda bottles going back to the manufacturers? If these companies choose to produce this excess waste, why aren't they paying for it? Lance, good question. And Michael, I'll throw it to you.
Actually, a number of programs have started under extended producer responsibility, where the producers of the material actually do pay for the reclamation and the recycling programs. And a good one, again, is our neighbor in Vermont, where they put in an electronics recovery program or recycling program. We actually were contracted by the state to start and initiate the program, ran it for the first 3 years, and it set a record of 7.7 pounds per Vermonter of electronics recovered. And in that case, any producer or manufacturer of an electronic component, whether Dell or HP or Toshiba, agreed to pay the cost of the recycling. And they got a bill from the state of Vermont. We coordinated with the vendor to pick up all the material, reprocess it through a certified green recovery system, and the producers absolutely stepped up. In the case of paint, which is a tremendous burden to our household hazardous waste programs, The National Producers of Paint, the Coatings Institute, has stepped up and said they will run a paint recovery program which would recycle 95% of all paint, latex and oil-based paint. So there are good examples where producers are stepping up to the plate. We need to do that with every commodity, as we said earlier.
So if someone in Vermont buys a TV or a new computer, all the packaging materials that go along with that, the cost of recycling those materials, whether it's styrofoam or boxes, are paid for by the manufacturer?
No, the recovery of your old computer that you don't use anymore, or your old printer.
I see.
The old electronics, not the packaging.
Got it.
They don't produce the cardboard that's shipped in. Obviously, Amazon would do that probably.
Yeah.
But in terms of the weight part, in New Hampshire right now, if you were to bring a television back to your transfer station, it costs you anywhere from $10 to $25.
I see.
Because there's a cost per pound to recycle it.
So most people just leave it by the curbside.
I've
seen that.
Well, there's too much of that, unfortunately. But some of the other places are Goodwill and Best Buy where you can take it in and they'll take it at no cost.
To recycle it.
So there are some companies that are doing that. We just need to do more. And I think the challenge for us in the recycling business is to get like Subaru and just be zero landfill. That's a great goal to aim for.
Well, and Lance's email reminds me of another question I wanted to ask you, John. What about states, I think there are about a dozen, that have so-called bottle bills where you get, 3 cents or 5 cents if you bring back the bottle for recycling?
Well, the economic studies I've seen on that show that that's actually a more costly method of recycling. It does force recycling because people will bring back those cans, and if you don't, somebody else will. So there's that. People have an incentive to pick stuff up off the side of the road because they can get a nickel or a dime for it. But on a cost per ton basis, when you figure in all the administrative costs, the studies I've seen say that it's cheaper to do it on a voluntary basis rather than a bottle bill basis.
All right. Let's
go
back.
But it does cut down on litter a lot.
Let's go back to our listeners. Mike joins us from Bedford. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Laura. I'd like to thank the panel for their service to the state's waste problems for decades, really. And I did plan on emphasizing the cost avoidance again, as the fellow from Lee did. In Bedford, we have a transfer station that can either throw it on one side for over 100 a ton or go into recycle for maybe even break-even cost or minus 10 sometimes. But what's even more important is the cans, again, the aluminum cans. Some states around us, all of them actually have bottle bills, and they just starve their recycling facilities for money, income. So there's times in the bringing back from the North Shore of Massachusetts recycling things for our facility in Bedford because theirs is an open where my daughter lives, things like that. I just wanted to emphasize that and see if the panel is aware of the problem of actually a bottle bill taking aluminum out of the cash flow of recycling.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike, and then I have another question for you, Duncan. Go ahead.
Real quickly, about 2 years ago, the value of those aluminum cans being sold from a transfer station likely equaled the nickel per can that you'd get in a bottle bill state. New Hampshire is the only state in New England that does not have a bottle bill. And I believe it was the University of Virginia about 6 years ago did a waste study on the side of the road. And fortunately for us, New Hampshire's roads are as clean, if not cleaner, than Vermont's or any of the other New England states without a bottle bill.
You know, to you, Duncan, picking up on his point about the transfer station is closed or whatever, there have been efforts to make it easier for folks to recycle. And there's always some frustration about why isn't the transfer station open until, 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock when a lot of folks don't get off from work until 6 and so forth. How do you perceive that sort of make it easy for folks conundrum?
Well, I mean, I think there's a two-part question. I mean, so yes, making it convenient for people to recycle in terms of, not dumbing it down, but just making it so that, they don't have to think too much about it, that they want to recycle, so they want to put things in the recycling bin that get recycled. And most people make an awful lot of mistakes with that kind of thing because while technically everything is recyclable, not everything is practically recyclable. And, for Keene, for instance, the majority of people have curbside service. So our facility is designed to cater to those commercial haulers who pick up the majority of recycling.
So you don't have to worry about the hours that you're open and so forth and people showing up and the gates are locked.
Yeah, but then that said, we also have 17,000 people a year who come to the facility to recycle because it's got a great view up there and they like coming up to make their dump run. They need to get out of the house. And so those people sometimes do get frustrated because we close at 3 o'clock on a weekday or 1 o'clock on a Saturday. And so they would like to have after work hours for them, for us to be able to offer them recycling. But from a cost standpoint, we haven't been able to justify it.
Well, and so speaking of making it convenient, I do have to ask you, gentlemen, about single stream recycling. This came up earlier, but we haven't talked about it a lot. And John, to you first, you know, this is an effort to make it even easier. You don't have to sort anything. You just dump all your recyclables in one bin. Some towns have it, some towns don't. From what I've heard, while it might increase people's rate of recycling, it's difficult on the facility end.
Right. And remember that recycling isn't putting it in the bin. Recycling is having that resource become something again, you know, a recycled can becoming a new can. And so with single stream, you're probably trading hopefully a higher rate of participation against probably a higher rate of contamination, because you put your half a can of Coke in with your cardboard, and you've kind of ruined a lot of your materials there.
So you can't use wet cardboard.
Well, it varies, I guess.
Speaking of somebody who has put a greasy pizza box in the recycling, you know.
I'll let others address that. But certainly the value of it goes down compared to a nice pristine stream. Now, okay. Roger Rice, who called in before, runs the lead transfer station, and his stream is – our stream, I should say, is pristine. So I think with single stream, there are a lot of questions that haven't been resolved yet, because we're still new to the game here. And it also is a matter of, are you talking about small city, big city, drop-off? And so there's, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all in any case.
Well, and here's an email from Sally, who makes a couple points, Sally in Webster. And Sally, I'm just going to jump on point number three here. She says, single-stream recycling is pernicious because it persuades people we have a, quote, technological fix using hugely expensive material recovery facilities to sort and dispose our trash. But Sally says, cross-contamination makes this business model unsustainable. Sally, thank you for the email. What do you think, Michael?
Well, she's hit the nail on the head. That's the crux of the two articles in the Washington Post that I think you might have seen. The idea that we've convinced everybody, let's make it easy, we'll up the participation rate, throw everything in the bin, even if you're not sure it's recyclable. Then it gets to the processing plant, and all of a sudden you go from a 10% contamination residual rate, and you're up to 20, 25, or 30%. This problem has become so extensive that there's a New England-wide steering committee addressing contamination in single-stream processing.
So is single-stream bad? Should we not do it?
It can't be done and can't be sustained the way we're doing it currently. The state of Rhode Island has a facility that everybody goes to, and they just launched a $300,000 ad campaign to convince them to put the right thing into the bucket, not the wrong thing. Garden hoses, grocery bags, lawnmower.
Christmas lights.
Lawnmower engines. It's,
lawnmower it's, engines.
It's metal. It'll fit in the container at the curbside. Lawnmower engines. So they're dealing with huge cost increases on the processing end, a lot caused by this contamination. And for a long time, we thought the glass was contaminating the cardboard. And we found out some of the downstream processes of glass are just as upset that the cardboard's contaminating the glass. I think it was Susan Collins from the Container Institute out in California said, once you make an omelet, it's awfully hard to unscramble that egg. And along with the drop in normal commodity pricing, we're seeing a real drop in the single-stream commodity pricing because of the contamination issue and because of the Chinese inspection ramp-up that they've done. The good news on that front is that for processing like Lee, where you have really good pure content of cardboard, they can actually get a premium for that material because it's never been contaminated. So there is some hope for good recycling.
So pizza boxes, yes or no?
Not the layer that has the grease on it, no. And there's a minimal amount of percentage of contamination. But the outside box, after you take the circle off and throw that away in the hopper, if you will, the rest of the box can be recycled. So
right.
Eat cleanly.
Let's take another call. This is Mike in Concord. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to give a shout. Hi, Mike Durport. Long time no talk, but just wanted to call in and discuss the logistics of recycling and the lifeline. Many times individuals, you know, they hear about, you know, where some of their material goes, but really, truly, I don't know if it's something that the general public is aware of. And, you know, creating a lifeline, understanding, you know, what the end use for this is, where it ends up. Is something that I think needs to be discussed, and, you know, if that's something that we could flush out in this conversation, along with the logistics that come into hand of, handling it going from, say Concord down to Massachusetts, from Massachusetts to a port in New Jersey to China. Are those costs in turn affecting the recycling rates?
So more public education, Mike, you're saying?
Yeah, actually, empowerment education.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling in. What do you think, John?
Oh, as far as education?
Yeah, and just people understanding, how long a lifeline that bottle or can or peanut butter jar
right.
really
actually,
has.
Actually, I would take it even farther. I mean, I think the focus on recycling versus landfilling is looking at the very end of the product's life. And that's important. But we're looking at the end of the pipe. We need to look at the whole pipeline. And, for example, one good/bad thing is that some containers now are made with a lot less material than they used to be. Aluminum cans now, if you notice, if you drop one and it's a carbonated beverage, you get a little pinhole and the thing erupts into a little geyser. Didn't used to do that. So they're using less aluminum per can. Good. But when we collect those at the recycling center, now we've got less weight per can. So that's our big moneymaker.
But if the most important thing in that reduce, reuse, recycle is reduce, that's a good thing then,
absolutely.
Isn't it?
That absolutely.
Using
it just,
lighter packaging.
It just our transfer station managers have to be, and they are very, very astute at trying to manage these changes. One point, just to get slightly off topic, Hood came up with this light block bottle to market their milk, because milk is milk, right? Well, they said, we have the light block bottle, which means we preserve flavor because light makes milk taste bad. And, well, they did increase their market share, but at the same time, all of a sudden now we went from having those sort of translucent milk jugs that were a pretty homogeneous stream to now you got all these white bottles in there, which, then you mix those. Do you mix them together? Do you separate them? And so transfer station managers tried to wine and dine us with a lot of yogurt and milk and explain why it wasn't a bad thing. But, it does complicate matters.
Well, here's an email from Grace, who says a couple points. And again, I'm going to share just two. She says the most important reason to recycle is to protect the environment for future generations, reduce problems with leaky, buried trash, litter, and non-recycled materials taking up space and causing environmental problems. Grace also says any financial or convenience benefit that towns can gain are a benefit, but not the main reason to drive recycling efforts. What do you think, Duncan? Don't focus so much on the economics of it. Just figure it out. But overall, this is worth it for the planet.
Well, I think that that's how recycling started, was, the environmental ethic of it, and then it became a business. And I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive, to be honest with you. I think that there are a number of environmental benefits that just happen to be the gravy on top of the fact that it's a reasonably good business model, except the fact that, we're sitting here talking about, how do we get our recycling rate from 30% to 35%? I mean, that's just pathetic. I mean, that's totally lame. We should be striving a lot higher than that. And the fact is that single stream was touted as the panacea for all of our problems, and it's too limiting. So we need to, again, look at the lessons that we're learning from it.
What do you mean too limiting?
It has only like 10 or 12 sorts in a single stream facility. We need to be looking a lot greater sorts so that these things that are causing problems in single stream can no longer be problems. They're just another resource that you're separating out into its various components.
Sorts means, glass on this conveyor belt and paper on this one. And
exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, we know what the composition of the waste stream is. This is not a mystery to us. I mean, it's like a mining operation. We're going after this, we're going after gold, and so we have to sift through all this stuff to get the gold. Well, in this particular case, we have all these resources, all this inherent energy value in these commodities, and we simply need to do a better job of taking these commodities in, all of them, and separating them into their various components. And some of them will, in fact, be better burned, for instance. They'll be best for their BTU value as fuel is the best thing. But in a lot of cases, turning that pizza box that has contamination into a new box, instead of throwing it away because it has that small amount of contamination, that's the direction we need to be going.
So that's the problem. Instead of being fussy and saying we don't want to recycle Christmas lights, we don't want to recycle, greasy pizza boxes, do a better job figuring out how to use everything.
Yes.
Why aren't we doing that, Mike?
We're back to the producer again. Make Christmas lights we can recycle. Don't make something that's not recyclable in the first place. Make it a requirement of the manufacturers. Real quick on the logistics point, we're retiring about 40,000 truck drivers in this country over the next 5 years. And the hauling, the logistics part of that equation is a huge impact on the cost of everything, including recycling.
Okay. All of you, real interesting. Thank you very much for being here. Duncan Watson, good to see you. Thank you. Duncan Watson is with the Keene Public Works Department. John Halstead, thank you also for being here.
Thank you.
John Halstead, he's at the UNH. And Mike Durfor, good to meet you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mike Durfor, Executive Director of the Northeast Resource Recovery Association. This is The Exchange on NHPR.